Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Tom Walsh for the appellant. This case involves the interpretation of a standard homeowner's policy, a farm owner's policy, and its typical business pursuits and exclusion. The plaintiff, Respondent Burns, was injured on the job at the Kennan Ready Mix plant as a result of the negligent act of our insured, Lynn Smith, who was his boss and the owner of the company. He got a judgment against Smith for $2 million. He collected $675,000 of it from Smith's liability insurer, another $150,000 from the workers' comp insurer, and then, pursuant to a 537.065 agreement, he filed this garnishment against our client based on Smith's farm owner's policy. Now, the farm owner's policy, which is basically a homeowner's policy for farmers, contains the standard business pursuits exclusion or exception. Business is defined in the policy as meaning, quote, a trade, profession, or occupation, excluding farming in this case, and the use of any premises or portion of residence premises for any such purpose. Now, although we think that definition is perfectly clear, the plaintiff asked this court to distort the meaning to hold that the coverage is precluded for business activities on the insured premises only, but not if they are incurred elsewhere in the United States, in Canada, or in free world. We think that's wrong grammatically and logically.
If that's wrong, why does it say, and the use of any premises or portion of residence premises for any such purposes? Because what does that add?
And there means as well as, in addition to.
Why does that add anything to the first part of the sentence?
Because without that, you have an ambiguity. If you have covered premises and you have excluded activities, then which prevails? This is designed to say that the exclusion prevails and that coverage is denied, not only for business activities generally, but even when they take place.
So why doesn't say that? And say,
I suggest that.
More directly, a trade, profession, or occupation, excluding farming, whether on the insured premises or residence premises or elsewhere.
Well, it just says it in different language. But and
well, that's the question.
Yeah, but and is a coordinating conjunction there, linking two independent clauses. Business means the trade, profession, or occupation, excluding farming, and business means the use of premises or a portion of residence premises for such purposes.
And if there were no numbers, isn't your argument weakened by the fact that they're numbered 1 and 2 and instead of 1, 2, and 3? And if there were no numbers, or if the second part of that clause had a number 2 in front of it and then the one about rentals had a number 3, wouldn't your argument be a lot stronger that they're independent?
I don't think so, because I think the and clause clearly works with the first exclusion. It's excluded for trade, business, or occupation, and it's also excluded even when those activities that are listed there.
Who gets to decide which definition of and we're supposed to use?
I think you have to use the one that's most logical in the circumstances.
Most logical to who?
Well, you have to look, the court said in the Todd case, you have to look at the purpose and the reason for the insurance. Why do parties enter into homeowners insurance? Well, it's certainly not to cover their business activities. I certainly don't think that if I commit malpractice in my law firm, that my homeowners policy is going to cover it. The cases and the commentators talk repeatedly about the purpose of homeowners insurance being to protect the premises.
How is that argument affected by this court's prior decision that what he did was not within the scope and course of his work? Does that present a different situation than if it? Because I know part of your argument and certainly his affidavit suggests that what he did was in the scope and course of his employment. But didn't this court hold in the prior case it was not?
No, they didn't hold it wasn't in the course of his employment. You held that it was an independent act of negligence on the job, which took it outside the workers' comp.
Which took it outside the scope and course of employment, and that's why it wasn't in workers' comp.
Well, it took it outside the protection of workers' comp, but clearly it was part of a business activity. It was on the premises of the cement company It was a negligent act, and yes, and he has his affidavit, of course, which says, you know, I didn't intend to have this insurance for my business activities. I was involved in a business activity when this happened, and moreover, you know, there are three cases that have faced this precise issue in the course of history, and this exception has been around for a long time in these very same terms.
In fact, didn't our Supreme Court decide this issue over 40 years ago, not with this specific language, with the add-on of the and, but in the Dickman versus Moran case, very, very similar language was used, but they ended it before the first conjunction that we have in the current policy. And had the clause ended after excluding farming, trade, profession, or occupation excluding farming, our Supreme Court has already said 42 years ago that that's the interpretation that you're arguing for, that if you put the period right there, you get the exact interpretation that you're asking this court to accept today. But what happened is, even though Farmers has knowledge of that opinion, that language, they chose, when they drafted this contract, to add language, to add conjunctions. And so we have to give meaning to all of those phrases, don't we?
I think that just clarifies the language that went before it. And I think the thrust of the Dickman case, as I remember, was whether these were ordinary activities that existed in the absence of the business relationship, which is the rest of the business pursuits definition. But I don't think that the addition of clarifying language changes the result. And as I was about to say, there are three cases that have addressed this precise issue. In 1992, the New Hampshire Supreme Court in the McCarty case said, no reasonable person could reach the conclusion proposed by the plaintiff. There is no ambiguity and coverage is denied. The Ohio Court of Appeals in 1976 said there is no merit in the insured's contention. And the Louisiana case, the Donovan case, also in 1976, construed the and to mean or in order to avoid what it called an incongruous or absurd result.
But the Donovan court did conclude that that very language was ambiguous, correct?
Well, I don't know. They said that we want to construe and to mean or here to avoid an ambiguity. So I guess, you know, in a way.
Is that the law in Missouri? It seems like to me there's a long history of cases that in the insurance law where if there's an ambiguity, we construe it in favor of insurance.
Well, if there's an ambiguity, the first thing you do is look for the intent of the parties. And now that's where we cross swords with our opponents.
Although, they say, is that, I know that's what we generally apply in a contract. Is that the way we interpret insurance contracts? Is that, look for the intent of the parties, has that been overridden by the rule that if, since insurance companies draft their own policies, they're experts, that if they draft a policy that's ambiguous, that the insured is favored as opposed to the company?
No, we've cited at least four cases in our brief holding that in the insurance context, first you look for the intent of the parties and you resort to contra pro forentum only as a last resort. Couch on Insurance, is very clear about that.
Don't we have about 100 or more cases in Missouri, though, that say if it's ambiguous, you construe it in favor of the insured, and they don't go through any of the other analysis because it's a policy matter since the insurer writes the policy and has the ability to change it to make it clearer. We have, in repeated cases, including ones this year, said if there's ambiguity, you construe it in favor of the insurer.
Well, I think, yes, there are a number of those cases, but I think in those cases, probably a search for the intent of the parties would have been fruitless. You had the underinsured case just recently, and, you know, who's going to be able to find out what the intent of the parties was in that case? But here, you've got a common type of insurance policy, a homeowner's policy, which is not written to cover business activities, and nobody thinks it is. And you've got the activity which is clearly off limits, off premises, and it seems to me that in light of the fact that the insured himself has said, I didn't buy this insurance to cover my business pursuits, he bought $1 million from another company.
But why did the insurer demand that he be defended in the underlying litigation?
Well, his lawyer did, and the evidence doesn't show why, but you always...
Well, the evidence does show he wrote that affidavit 2 weeks after the judgment against him in this case, and while it was up on appeal and these issues were at issue. So it was strange timing to suddenly do that affidavit after the judgment had already been entered in the underlying suit.
Well, you've got, you know, you've got the 537-065 agreement, and that in itself raises some issues. But for me, in addition to the problem created by contra pro forentum in favor of the insured, he's not the insured in this case. He's a stranger to the contract. So why should we have a policy that requires why should we have a public policy that requires an insurance policy to be construed in favor of a stranger? Now, that we have two cases from ancient history, basically, that support that view, and I haven't seen it argued the other way. But I don't know how he becomes entitled to that, the benefit of that construction.
But 537-065 changes things, doesn't it? I mean, our legislature, in its wisdom, decided that this was an appropriate piece of legislation to have, that when an insurance company, according to the insured believes that the insured has coverage, but his insurance company won't provide him coverage, then Missouri is pretty unique in this situation in that legislatively we give the right to the insured under 065 to enter into one of these agreements. And so maybe unlike many other states, the state of Missouri has made a statement legislatively about that topic.
That's true, but you know, I suggest that those agreements are subject to abuse, and as the court held in Noble, by requiring at least a reasonable analysis. But
You certainly had the ability to prohibit that agreement being entered into. In this case, you could have, couldn't you have filed a declaratory judgment action early on regarding this issue or not?
Could have, yes. But we felt that there was no coverage, and we denied coverage. We originally defended under a reservation of rights, but when they objected to that, we withdrew. But he was defended. Smith was defended at the trial by his liability carrier for Kennan, which was the Oak River Insurance Company. I would just urge the court that you can't adopt contra pro forentum if it reaches an absurd result. That's what the Southern District held. And it is absurd in this case to say that the homeowner is protected at his distant location, wherever he might be, except on the very premises in which he paid to insure. And that's what they want you to hold. Thank you.
May it please the court, Anthony DeWitt for Mr. Burns. I will be brief and answer any of the questions of the court, but I think the real issue here is one of the standard of review. This is a case of a self-inflicted injury by an insurance company. It doesn't mean we're responsible for sloppy draftsmanship. Our rules of construction and the standard of review say that with an exclusionary language in an insurance policy, it must be clear and unambiguous in order to be enforced. Not clear or unambiguous, it has to be clear and unambiguous to be enforced. And although Mr. Walsh has done a Herculean job of trying to make this look like it's not ambiguous, it simply is ambiguous. The way it is drafted, we're sitting here arguing over what the word and means, a task that is appropriate, I guess, for presidents and other lawyers, but certainly not for us. This is an ambiguous policy language, and if it's ambiguous in an exclusion, it is construed against the drafter.
In determining whether it's ambiguous, is it appropriate to look at the rest of the policy and the policy scheme? That is, this is a farm owner's policy. It's not a policy for all business everywhere.
Well,
it's only ambiguous if you don't look at it in that context.
Well, I don't think it's, well, first of all, the business pursuits exception is not itself defined. Only the term business is defined. And this, as Judge Stith pointed out, is one of those cases where you should have stopped where you were ahead. If it had ended after excluding farming, we'd be done here. And I think the Southern District admitted that. It is a general rule that contracts and insurance contracts are construed as a whole. I think that's true. But it's important to realize that this is personal liability coverage. And under Burns versus Smith, the case that was written by Judge Limbaugh in this court a couple of years ago, the liability was very clearly for the personal breach of the duty to our client. And because it was personal for the breach of that personal duty, you really can't say that it was in a business or that it falls within the business exception. So the other thing that I think is important, Mr. Walsh said that and could be defined as well as and in addition to, and of course at the trial court level, he said it could be defined as or, and he relies on the case from Louisiana that says and means or. And, you know, we're Missourians, we're plain spoken folks, and ought to mean and. It, when we write an MII instruction and it requires breach of duty and damages, we don't get by with inserting an or where the and should be. And should mean and here. And if it means and, it means that you have to have used the farm premises or his premises that was insured as part of what caused the injury. And in this case, the premises weren't involved. It happened at Ken and Ready Mix.
Mr. Walsh says that if you read it as and, though, it leads to an absurd result, and therefore you have to look further.
I don't think it leads to an absurd result. If you look at that language carefully, what they could have been trying to say, and again, I'm trying to interpret language that is not clear, but it seems to me that what they were getting at is if you run a daycare out of that house, then that's excluded because you're running the daycare on the farm premises and you're operating a business on the premises. Similarly, if he had been welding in his garage for somebody who brought in a farm implement to be welded and someone was hurt. Again, if he's welding on the premises, operating a welding business, I think that's excluded.
What about the policyholder's affidavit and his thought that this type of activity would not have been covered?
Well, as Judge Wolf pointed out in a case recently, we don't condone recanting testimony. And, you know, I've always heard that you look not at what people say, but at what people do. And when he still had some risk in this case, he asked the insurance company to defend him and indemnify him. And they made the determination that they did not need to. He executed that affidavit only after he had executed the 537.065 agreement. And as Judge Pfeiffer points out, that's a statutorily created exception that allows us to give less credence to that affidavit because at this point, all he's trying to do, I think, is satisfy his insurance company and keep them out of trouble.
Mr. DeWitt, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Excuse me. What about the phrase any premises, though, when we look at that exclusion?
Well, it's a use exclusion, not a geographic exclusion. If you look at the language, it says the use of the premises. It doesn't say, it doesn't create really a geographic limitation. It creates a limitation with respect to the use of those premises. So if you give that language some credence, again, we're in an exclusion, and what effect to give that language is so unclear from this policy that if you construe it against the insured, it works an injustice. And I believe that the Missouri case law is very clear that we don't go to the intent of the parties, first of all, unless it's ambiguous. But in a situation like this where it's in an exclusionary clause, that is construed strictly against the drafter. Coverage is construed broadly to afford the best coverage, and exclusions are construed narrowly so as not to defeat coverage that was intended to be granted by the other coverage.
Let me ask you. I mean, this is, we've been talking about the same thing in a lot of different ways, and apart from the specific language, the general intent, this is a farm owner's, ranch owner's policy. It's related to premises. On the premises, the conduct of other business is excluded. Why should one assume that the policy would cover business conduct outside the premises if it's excluded on the premises?
Well, again, My view of that is this is personal liability coverage. It's under Section 2, which affords personal liability coverage of $1 million. And what the action was against Mr. Smith was for his personal liability. It wasn't for his business's liability. It was for the liability of Lynn Smith as Lynn Smith.
And so it's a policy within a policy almost.
It really is.
Is that what you're saying, a personal liability policy within a broader farm owners or ranch
right.
owners policy?
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. And, you know, again, you could, I suppose that there are a number of reasonable interpretations of what that language means, but if there's not one clear meaning, since our standard of review is clear and unambiguous, if it's not clear, we shouldn't enforce it against the insured. If it is ambiguous, we should not enforce it against the insured. And here, it is neither clear nor nor unambiguous.
Can I ask you a question related to the damages issue,
please?
Do I understand that you agree that the insurer, if you win on the liability issue, the damages are $1 million, that's the coverage, plus then we have the question about interest, pre- and post-judgment interest. Your argument is that you get pre-judgment interest and post-judgment interest on the entire judgment, even though this insurer is only responsible for $1 million of it. Can you explain to me why we would say you get interest on something somebody from this insurer that someone else owes?
Well,
on an underlying amount that somebody else owes.
We're relying on Inulat, and in fact, in their reply brief, the defendant suggests that you need to overrule Inulat, and I don't think you do. I think that sort of gives testimony to the fact that they're on marshy ground here.
But I hope that logically answers. If they owe $1 million, why do they owe interest on $2 million?
Because the language of the policy, if you'll hold on a second, I will get that language. I apologize. I had this out a little earlier.
It says on the judgment, but doesn't it mean the judgment against them, and that's the million?
Well, I think what it goes to more than anything else is the language does not exclude. Well, I should start back with Inulat, where basically they refused to defend or indemnify, and that breached the contract. And because of that, you don't want to put them in a position where they are better off having breached their contract than if they'd honored their contract. If they had honored their contract, then they would have had an ability to at least have some control and input into whether or not this judgment was of the size that it was.
And I understand that would be why you would argue that since they had a policy of $1 million and that limited their liability, if they had honored it, that you would have gotten that money up front and you would have had interest on that money. But I'm not clear why that entitles you to interest on the part of the judgment paid by a different insurer.
So in that situation, are we dealing with pre-judgment or post-judgment?
Both of them.
Well, I think it is unclear in the law whether or not I haven't found anything that I think is truly on point or on all fours with this case, because you do have that odd situation where one insurer came in and paid something after a judgment. We believe, as we pointed out, we don't think they preserved that issue, but if they did, then, as we pointed out in our brief, we believe that, you know, if the court wants to exercise its equitable powers and reduce that amount by
on the
amount
post-judgment.
Of the interest.
You said that on the post-judgment.
On the post-judgment. I don't think that same language applies to the pre-judgment because it deals specifically with Inulat.
And Tom, I'm sorry, I interrupted your explanation of why Inulat addresses this.
Well, basically because you don't want to put the insurer in the position of being better off for having breached its contract than if it had honored its contract. That's the policy language that's used in Inulat.
And how does that apply to the pre-judgment interest here?
The company will pay, in addition to the applicable limit of liability, prejudgment interest awarded against the insured on that part of the company pays. If the company makes an offer to pay the applicable limits of its liability, the company will not pay any prejudgment interest based on that period of time after the offer. It seems to me that that language from the policy ought to obligate them under INULAT to pay because they didn't ever attempt to pay any of this or put their policy limits in into the court in order to stop the running of prejudgment interest. So,
yeah, but isn't that the distinction, though? The policy is saying that if they had made the offer, from that point on, they don't have to pay any prejudgment interest if they had made the offer and it had been rejected. But they're essentially self-penalized by their own language that they are going to have to pay prejudgment interest if they have not made the offer, but they specifically restrict how much prejudgment interest they'll pay. And didn't the Western District in Miller versus Secura Insurance, even though they were talking about post-judgment interest, they referred to the fact that the insurance company could have used the exact same language they did on their prejudgment interest to limit the amount of interest, but they chose not to do so. So in effect, Miller looked at this exact language and said, see, that's how you do it if you want to limit the amount of insurance.
I believe that's right, Your Honor. Okay. I believe that's correct. This is a difficult case, and I'm happy to answer any additional questions, but I don't have any further material prepared for the court. Thank you, Your
Honor.
Thank
you very much.
Counsel has said in his brief and in argument that this is a personal liability policy. Well, it's not. It's a homeowner's policy with a personal liability provision for liability incurred on the homeowner's premises. If you look at the premium structure, you can see that the personal liability is a very subsidiary aspect of this and couldn't possibly be construed to mean business pursuits all over the world, cover business pursuits all over the world. Less than 20% of the premium is allocated to Section 2, which is the personal liability section.
If his tools or equipment would have been stolen from some location, not on the, quote, insured premises, would it have been covered under this policy? Aren't there other provisions in this policy that provide for coverage for incidents or losses that don't necessarily occur from what you're calling the premises?
Well, not that I'm aware of. You have exclusions for automobile, because that's covered by separate kind of insurance. You have exclusion for products liability, same reason.
What about his farm equipment, or if his welder was stolen from some location that wasn't on what you're thinking of as the premises? Would that have been a covered loss?
If it's his farming equipment, somebody steals it and off-premises injure somebody? I don't know.
Just steals it.
What about if the welder was at the location the man was injured?
Well, if
and was stolen.
The
from
question
that,
would
then
would
be covered?
Is that farming activity?
No. That's the question. Would that be covered there as part of loss?
Isn't that a covered loss under this policy?
If it's a farming loss, perhaps. But if it's a business beyond farming, no.
The cases where we've had homeowners policies where there's been a case of mistaken identity and there's an intentional act exclusion, and so somebody negligently, perhaps in the dark or for whatever reason, they think that they have to defend themselves from attack when in reality they were negligent in thinking so, and so they punch somebody. And homeowners policies with that same personal liability language have been found to provide coverage
sure.
in that situation.
That's what the personal liability coverage is for. If something happens on the premises, somebody slips and falls.
No. This is off the premises, though. There have been cases where it's not on in defense or negligent defense of the home, off the premises, where courts have said that there's coverage for that situation.
I'm not aware of any such cases, okay. And I would argue that those are wrongly decided if that's what they held. You have to look at the purpose of the insurance. You have to look at the conduct of the parties. And not only can you not construe something under contra pro forensum, which will create an absurd result, I suggest that you can't give the policy an absurd meaning to create an ambiguity. That's the problem here. The only result they're proposing as being ambiguous in the policy is absurd. It is backwards from what the policy is obviously intended to provide and what both parties acknowledge policy was intended to provide and what the policy was intended to exclude. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be taken under submission. The court is now